Hi, and welcome back to another one of my podcasts based on my 78 RPM record collection. There's a sort of theme to this one. It's all about records which were slightly wrong. Something shouldn't have happened. Sometimes seriously, sometimes comically, but there's something wrong with all of these. The greatest of all operatic tenors, Enrico Caruso, first made his name by walking into a hotel room in Milan in 1902 and running off 10 recordings in about an hour, I'm told, and they were put out. Of course, he had no idea at the time that people would be listening to these recordings over 100 years later, nor had he any idea that these recordings would launch him into international fame, which is probably why he didn't check on the quality of his performances. One of the arias, which he later recorded several times more, and indeed probably its definitive performance in 1909, was E lucevan le stelle from La Tosca, which, remember, in 1902 was pretty much a brand new opera, which may explain why Caruso completely bungles the whole thing. He comes in the wrong place, in the wrong key, and only his innate musicality, together with that of probably the very puzzled accompanist, manages to get them together again about sort of 30-45 seconds into the recording. So it's really interesting to hear the greatest of tenors sing this way. The weird thing is that the record was put out. It was issued at the time, and the only reason I can think of for this is the fact that nobody else really knew how the tune went yet either, because, as I say, I think that the whole opera had only been premiered about, 18 months or so before, something like that anyway. So here is Caruso on one of his very, very few bad recordings. This, it's sung well enough, except he just gets it all wrong. So back we go to that Milan hotel room. And this was recorded way back on the 11th of April, 1902. Recorded at the strange speed of just over 71 RPM, but we've corrected that. Enrico Caruso messes up E lucevan le stelle. Caruso would never have let that go out later on in his career. He was very, very careful about which take, which performance was let out. But in those days, at the age of, 29, he was yet to find out that he would be a world name. Well, another name that has remained completely unknown is our next artist. A lot of people collect 78s of dance bands. There are American dance bands, which we tend to like because they're on the verge of being jazz bands and they swing and they just grab your ears. And then there are British dance bands, which sadly we were catching up with the Americans, and particularly in the 20s, we seemed to be streets behind them because we were just imitating what was then sort of exotic foreign music. That said, a lot of people collect British dance bands, especially, strangely, Americans, who obviously find it, strange and foreign and have got a certain sort of vintage appeal. I don't know, but they're very popular. A lot of Americans love British dance bands. And I don't just mean the big names like Jack Hilton, Roy Fox, and all the big names that came later, which admittedly had very good bands. But way back in the 20s, before even there were microphones available, there were British dance bands. There were hotels that wanted to have dances, etc., etc. Now, I have no idea who Leslie Jeffries was, and nor his obviously nom de studio, Albert Allen, because that's what's on the label. This is billed as Albert Allen's Palais de Danse Orchestra. A discography of British dance bands tells me that it's really Leslie Jeffries, which leaves me none the wiser. This was recorded in April of 1924 with the old acoustic process. Now, there's nothing particularly wrong with this recording. Everything they need to do is done. That's not the greatest musical experience of my life. So why am I including this in the Something's Wrong department? Well, I've always found this track fascinating ever since I obtained this 78 years ago. I'm not quite sure how even. And that's because it sounds like a waltz. But whatever you do, don't try and get up and dance a waltz to it because you'll fall over and break both your legs. This, unbelievably, is in 5-4. And on the label it says it's a 5-step. This is nothing like Take 5 by the Dave Brubeck Quartet, which has got a rhythm of sort of doom-ba, ba-da, doom-dum, doom-ba, ba-da, sort of jazzy. No. This sounds like a waltz, except it isn't. Count the beats. It's 5-4. And because of that, I'm going to play it for you now. It's called Cara. It's a 5-step recorded in April 1924 by Leslie Jeffries with his nom de studio Albert Allen and his Palais de Danse Orchestra, Cara. Thank you. There you are, a little bit of posthumous fame for Leslie Jeffries, otherwise known as Albert Allen and his Palais de Danse Orchestra. Well, another really big name was, of course, Bing Crosby. He was sometimes known as One Shot Crosby because he'd roll into the recording session, sing his song, first take, and swan off again so that he could go golfing or whatever else he wanted to do that day. Very casual, very professional, of course. However, as with anybody else, things could go wrong. Now, my experience in certainly TV studios is that if you do a take which you're not happy with, they will nevertheless lie to you and say, "Oh, that was wonderful, wonderful." They just want to get on with things and are interested in whether you are seen to your best advantage or not. All they care about is if there's a glitch in the sound quality or maybe there's a shadow in the wrong place. They really don't care about your performance at all. They pretend they do, but they don't. So if you want to make sure they don't use that take, you have to actually stop singing or swear or something of the sort. No doubt things were the same back in 1939 in June when Bing Crosby came into the studio to record a wonderful song called Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams with the John Scott Trotter Orchestra. As you'll hear, something was wrong with the arrangement that he was told about. Something happened that he didn't realize was going to. They sort of shortened it without telling him, and he wasn't happy. So he starts singing completely wrong words, including, my goodness, the word bastard. Oh, you couldn't have that out in America before the war. Always strangely very, very easy to shock the United States. Why, I don't know, but they are. The result is that this track never went out. You can hear the orchestra laughing when he starts singing the wrong words, but like the true pros that they were, just so that they didn't get the blame for anything, the violins carry on playing, and indeed the entire orchestra, right to the end of the track. Somebody obviously was very amused by this, and copies of this outtake, very much an outtake, were pressed and circulated, and I've got a copy. Now, to add to the things that are wrong, this is in very, very poor sound quality. I really ought not to be putting it out at all, simply because of that reason, but it is very entertaining. It all starts happening about the last 25% of the recording, so hang on, it will go wrong towards the end. Here is then Bing Crosby in his outtake of Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams, 1939.
When skies are cloudy and gray, they're only gray for a day. So wrap your troubles in dreams and dream your troubles away. Until that sunshine peeps through, there's only one thing to do. Just wrap your troubles in dreams and dream your troubles away. Castles may tumble, that's fate after all. Life's really funny that way. No use to grumble, just smile as they fall. Weren't you keen for a day? Just remember that sunshine always follows the rain. Wrap your troubles in dreams. Dream your troubles away. Whistle and dream your cares away. Castles may tumble, that's fate after all. Life's really funny that way. Sang the wrong melody, we'll play it back. See what it sounds like, hey, hey. They cut out 8 bars, the dirty bastard. I didn't know which 8 bars he was gonna cut. Why don't somebody tell me these things around here? Holy Christ, I'm going off my nut.
Bing Crosby apparently going off his nut. Well, I'm recording this in June 2011, and it's during this last year that we've had this great success with a film called The King's Speech, referring to the first major speech given by King George VI. However, I suspect that if you'd have asked somebody in Great Britain around that time what the phrase The King's Speech meant to them, it wouldn't be this speech by King George VI, it would be the speech given by his elder brother, strictly speaking when he was no longer king, at the moment of his abdication. Sometimes you hear little bits of this as part of programs on the radio, but rarely do you get a chance to hear the full speech. Here it is, all 6 minutes of it, not in great sound, but perfectly audible so you can hear everything that he says. Despite the words, I have doubts as to whether no pressure was put upon him. In fact, I'm pretty sure that Baldwin, the Prime Minister of the time, put tremendous pressure on him to either abdicate or preferably give up the woman that he loved, neither of which he wanted to do, but in the end he was forced to choose the former. So this is the moment of his leaving the throne. Little did he know that he was hardly ever to see Great Britain again. So it's quite a dramatic... We can listen to this with dramatic irony because we know what was to happen next. He didn't. He didn't even know about World War II coming along at that point. So here again, in December 1936, at the moment of his abdication, here is King Edward VIII, or as he already was, the Duke of Windsor.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I have never wanted to withhold anything. But until now, it has not been constitutionally possible for me to speak. A few hours ago, I discharged my last duties as king and emperor. And now that I have been succeeded by my brother, the Duke of York, my first words must be to declare my allegiance to him. This I do with all my heart. You all know the reasons which have impelled me to renounce the throne. But I want you to understand that in making up my mind, I did not forget the country or the empire, which, as Prince of Wales, and lately as king, I have for 25 years tried to serve. But you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love. And I want you to know that the decision I have made has been mine and mine alone. This was a thing I had to judge entirely for myself. The other person most nearly concerned has tried up to the last to persuade me to take a different course. I have made this the most serious decision of my life only upon the single thought of what would in the end be best for all. This decision has been made less difficult to me by the sure knowledge that my brother, with his long training in the public affairs of this country, and with his fine qualities, will be able to take my place forthwith, without interruption or injury to the life and progress of the empire. And he has one matchless blessing, enjoyed by so many of you, and not bestowed on me, a happy home with his wife and children. During these hard days, I have been comforted by Her Majesty, my mother, and by my family. The ministers of the Crown, and in particular Mr. Baldwin, the Prime Minister, have always treated me with full consideration. There has never been any constitutional difference between me and them, and between me and Parliament. Bred in the constitutional tradition by my father, I should never have allowed any such issue to arise. Ever since I was Prince of Wales, and later on when I occupied the throne, I have been treated with the greatest kindness by all classes of the people, wherever I have lived or journeyed throughout the empire. For that, I am very grateful. I now quit altogether public affairs, and I lay down my burden. It may be some time before I return to my native land, but I shall always follow the fortunes of the British race and empire with profound interest. And if, at any time in the future, I can be found of service to His Majesty in a private station, I shall not fail. And now we all have a new king. I wish him and you, his people, happiness and prosperity with all my heart. God bless you all. God save the King.
The famous abdication of Edward VIII, that was recorded on the 11th of December 1936. His father had only died in January, so he had a really short reign. Things haven't moved on that much, even today, because there was a lot of fuss about the fact that Prince Charles wanted to marry the person he always really loved, Camilla. Only now, rather than him having to abdicate any chance of being king, it's she who has to do so. Still, they worry about these formal things about the constitution and what is right and what isn't. Seems very daft to me. However, this whole program is about things that didn't go right. If there could hardly be anything more wrong than losing the throne, I suppose the worst thing even than that is to lose your life prematurely. And that's of course what happened to Fats Waller, who was born on the 21st of May 1904, died on the 18th of December 1943. A lot of this was, I suppose, self-inflicted, because he didn't exactly look after his health. He was well overweight, drank and smoked to excess, did everything he could possibly do to die early, and succeeded. He was, 39, and he died of pneumonia on a train. Just after he died, a record company called ASH, that's A-S-C-H, decided to put out an album, literally an album, four records in a sort of book of 78s, as a sort of tribute to his life. They chose two pianists. One was Earl Hines, the great Earl Hines, But the other two records were made by a young man called Nat Jaffa, and his case is even more tragic than Fats's because he died even younger and really through no fault of his own. He was born, I assume he must have been Jewish because of his name, he was born in New York on the 1st of January 1918. His family moved to Germany 3 years later, where he spent 10 years, during which he took piano lessons, probably classical piano lessons. They returned to America, New York, in the early 30s, probably having got wind of what was going on with the Nazis, I don't know. As soon as he arrived back in New York, he obviously dived into the jazz scene, because by the late 30s, when he was, what, just 20 years old, he was already being used by some of the greatest artists around. Louis Armstrong was one of them. Charlie Barnett used him. This is a really young man. And Ash chose him as one of these two people because his style is interesting. It mixes the sort of stride piano of Fats Waller with more modern styles of music that were just coming along. So he's very much a crossover pianist. Really fine musician. He was to die tragically just about a year later on the 5th of August 1945 due to complications, something to do with very high blood pressure. His last recording was to accompany a track with Sarah Vaughan. So here is this young man, lost to the world, great jazz pianist. We should be talking about him. I am talking about him. This is Nat Jaffa playing one of Fats Waller's famous songs, Keeping Out of Mischief Now, recorded in February 1944. And there, amongst all these other going wrongs, a real tragic going wrong, one of the few recordings of that very fine pianist, Nat Jaffa. Sadly forgotten now, shouldn't be. He was accompanied there by Sid Jacobs on bass, and as I said before, the recording was made in February 1944. However, let's end the 78th part of my show with something a little bit more amusing, shall we say. I started with a complete foul up by Caruso. The other great tenor of the century was surely Beniamino Gigli. Now, in 1954, I think it was, towards the end of his life, when he was indeed 64 years old, strangely the age I am now, somebody had the idea of him recording some songs which weren't exactly his normal type of song. song. Way back in 1927, the great Irish tenor John McCormack had sung a famous Irish song called Mother Machree, very Irish, and the English involved in the lyric is so Irish that even English people won't sound really convincing when singing this song. McCormack's version is definitive. What idiot decided that Beniamino Gigli should attempt this song? Goodness knows, it just sounds ridiculous. To be honest, he sings it beautifully, but God keep you and the Mother Machree. He can't pronounce the word hair properly. Everything's wrong. It's absolute disaster. Very funny, I think, despite the fine singing. So I'm going to end in a record which was indeed not put out in his lifetime. Of course, once you die, they put everything out they can get their hands on. This is Beniamino Gigli's very, very idiosyncratic version, to put it mildly, of the famous Irish song Mother Machree, recorded on the 17th of April, 1954.
There's a spot in my heart which no glory may hold. There's a depth in my soul never sounded or known. There's a place in my memory, my love, that you fear. No other can take it. No one else. Dear silver that shine in your hair, and the brow that sulfur rolled and wrinkled with care. I kiss that dear thing, and some time will for me.
Honestly, I have no idea whose idea it was to get Beniamino Gigli to try and sing an Irish song. Absolutely potty idea. But there you are, these things happen. Well, this is the end of the show once more. Before I close it, yet again, I beg you to send the link to your friends so that this music can be shared. If you can't remember the link, just tell them to do a search for Earl Oakin's Gramophone Show, because if you do that, it comes up straight away. Let's share the music. It's great. I mean, this was a particular program with the theme of things going wrong, but usually, as you know, it's some of the best music ever recorded. Well, that said, my usual plea, I'm going to play one of my own tracks, and this, again, is something that shouldn't have happened. First of all, the sound quality isn't that good, because all I have is a very, very crude demo of this, which I must have recorded on my tape recorder 30 years ago. I never have recorded it properly. I must do that at some point. And the subject matter of the lyric is about something which also shouldn't happen. It's the end of a love affair, very sad. So it fits into the theme. And with this, I leave you till next time, hoping that you enjoyed some of this. It's always rather good when your heroes screw up badly, rather like somebody pompous and very important slipping on a banana peel. Caruso and Gigli, the greatest tenors of all, and their worst moment. Well, that's it for now. Until the next time, I wish you all the very best and hope that you'll be back in August. Ciao for now.
The time has come to sing the final song for you. What should it say? Though I may never more have you to hold, it speaks of love. Somewhere, sometime, our eyes may meet again and smile. For nights we knew, or shall we find again our shining star and speak of love? To speak of love and whisper words that melt so deep inside, lighting all the shadows of my dreams, and in your eyes to realize there comes a moment that should last forever. Star is fading now, but oh, how bright it was. And as I turn again, I see it shine and remember. Speak.